Well, our passage tonight in 2 Chronicles chapter 4 is very similar to the text found in 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7, where Solomon builds the temple. In fact, in many places in this particular chapter, the chronicler actually quotes word for word from the sections of text from 1 Kings 6 and 7, which suggests that he was probably looking at a copy of the text of 1 Kings as he's writing here. Although there are other places where it's a little different. The order is different, the arrangement is different, some of the word choice is different. Which leaves us then the task of asking, why make those changes? If you're going to bother to quote from 1 Kings 6 and 7, why not just quote all of it? We've already seen that the chronicler is quite innovative when it comes to using previous texts in the reusing, the reordering, the retelling of previous accounts. We saw that two weeks ago, with 2 Chronicles chapter 3, where he ties the temple to Mount Moriah and the sacrifice of Isaac. The chronicler definitely has a different agenda than we've seen in the book of 1 Kings. He's writing for a different time and for a different purpose, but the task for us is to ask, so what is that purpose? Which means that we first have to look at 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7 in order that we're able to see the difference, to see the first text, the pattern as it were, and then see the differences that are made here in 1 Chronicles. 1 Kings chapter 6 and 1 Kings chapter 7 divide very neatly into two sections. 1 Kings chapter 6 is about everything inside the temple. Chapter 7 is about the various artifacts that are outside the temple. Actually, right in the middle, 1 Kings 7 actually begins with a description of Solomon's palace that seems to break up the two descriptions of the temple. So we go from the building itself and what's inside the temple to Solomon's palace, to what's outside the temple. The chronicler, though, doesn't mention Solomon's palace. He only mentions the temple itself. And yet, for the chronicler, the whole account is one account and everything's all mixed together. It's much more difficult to divide it into sections than in Kings. For example, the two pillars that stood outside the temple, that's recorded in 1 Kings chapter 7, because it's outside the temple, and that's the chapter that's everything outside the temple. That's where the furniture and the appliances are for around the temple. But in 2 Chronicles, the pillars are actually recorded alongside the cherubim, which are inside the temple. The cherubim are found in 1 Kings chapter 6, because that's where everything inside the temple is found. But here in Chronicles chapter 4, he has mixed everything together. He no longer has that division of inside and outside. We're left with kind of this question of why, though, because that division in Kings is very clear. And 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7 also has another structural difference. It's not just about inside and outside, but 1 Kings chapter 6 is everything that Solomon makes. 1 Kings chapter 7, the stuff that's outside, that's what Huram-Abi makes. He makes everything outside. Solomon, in essence, is given credit for everything inside the temple. So that we read in 1 Kings chapter 7, Solomon made all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord. Huram-Abi, on the other hand, he makes everything outside the temple, which is why Solomon makes everything of gold and Huram-Abi makes everything of bronze, because everything gold goes inside the temple and everything bronze goes outside the temple. Thus we read in 1 Kings 7, verse 14, Huram-Abi was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. He was full of wisdom and understanding and skill for making any work in bronze. Bronze is the only thing that Huram-Abi is given credit for in the book of Kings. He makes the two pillars outside the temple because those are made of bronze. And because they're outside the temple, they're found in 1 Kings chapter 7. The cherubim, which are inside the temple, are made of gold. And so those are found and given credit to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 6. So 1 Kings 6 and 7 has a very clear structure. 1 Kings chapter 6, everything inside the temple. Everything made of gold, everything given credit to Solomon. Everything outside the temple is made of bronze, and you give credit to Huram-Abi. Very clear, very, very clear distinction. And yet what's odd about all of it is that Solomon didn't make anything. At least I don't think Solomon made anything. I'm working on an assumption here that Solomon himself did not actually cast everything of gold or overlay the inside of the temple with gold. Solomon had servants to do all of that work, and yet he's still the figurehead that is highlighted as working in the temple, constructing everything of gold. No other craftsman is mentioned in any of this except for Solomon in the temple, Huram-Abi working with bronze outside the temple. And I really can't even tell you why the writer of Kings decides to break it up that way. I don't know if perhaps he just wants to emphasize that everything outside the temple is bronze and everything inside the temple is gold. That's very similar to the account in Exodus. It's also possible that he's just a little uncomfortable with a man from Tyre, who's a half-Gentile, making anything in the temple. So it's possible that he's avoided that in the book of Kings, not giving credit to anything in the temple at the hands of Hammurabi. And yet we come to Chronicles, and the chronicler doesn't care about any of that. The chronicler doesn't keep those distinctions. He doesn't keep those divisions. He doesn't really care who made what. He puts the pillars with the cherubim, as I mentioned, but he also mixes the different types of metals that Hammurabi works with. Rather than only working with bronze, he also works with gold. Verse 7 here, and he made 10 golden lampstands. And we assume, since we've had all these he made, starting in chapter 3, that the he made is probably Solomon. And that's kind of what we assume. Solomon made the lampstands. But then we come to verse 11 and we read, Hiram also made. And so suddenly we're left thinking, look, we had this very clear distinction in Kings. When we said he made, we knew who exactly we were talking about. Chapter 6, he is Solomon. Chapter 7, he is Hiram. Now we come here to 2 Chronicles chapter 4, and we got this he, and we don't know who he is. Is it Hiram that's making the lampstands, or is it Solomon that's making the lampstands? We read that Solomon has been making pieces of furniture, not just of bronze, so that we read in verse 16, the pots, the shovels, the forks, all the equipment he made of burnished bronze for King Solomon for the house of the Lord. But then we find that these lampstands are made of gold, and apparently he made those as well in chapter 7. All of which to say the chronicler doesn't really seem to care who made what or what it's made out of. In fact, he tells us that Hiram is not just a worker in bronze the way he is in Kings, but that Hiram actually works with gold, silver, and other materials. So that we have this account that's really fluid, really mixed together. The chronicler has taken all of his information from Kings and has just mixed it all up. No longer the nice division. In fact, he even quotes in verse 48 here, he even quotes from 1 Kings, quoting the emphasis from 1 Kings on Solomon making all the vessels in the house of the Lord, the vessels that were gold, the golden altar, the golden table. But up until verse 48, there's been no indication whatsoever that the chronicler really cares what anything is made out of or who's making it. Not to mention that the writer of Kings, in an effort to keep bronze and gold separate, Solomon and Hiram separate, doesn't actually talk about everything that's in the temple. He doesn't really emphasize all of the furniture that's even present at the temple. The tables that are mentioned here in 2 Chronicles, those golden tables, they're not even mentioned in the book of Kings. Nor is the bronze altar here in chapter 4, verse 1, mentioned at all, which is a pretty significant detail since that's the whole reason that the temple exists, in order to offer sacrifices, and yet Kings doesn't even mention the altar. But I think that begins to give us some insight into what exactly the chronicler is considering important here as he's writing, more or differently important than the writer of Kings. The writer of Kings seems to be emphasizing Solomon. That's part of why he separated Solomon from Hiram. He's trying to get us to understand how wise Solomon is in designing everything in the temple. There's almost an admission, as it were, that Hiram actually made some things. We're not really all that interested in what he's making, but he made some things in 1 Kings 7. And yet the emphasis even in 1 Kings 7 seems to be how wise that Solomon went and found Hiram to come and make all these things of bronze. So even there, the emphasis is still on Solomon in Kings, which is why the writer of Kings seems to insert that description of Solomon's palace. Because it's all about Solomon. Look how wise Solomon is. Look at everything that Solomon did. Solomon organized this. Look at how wealthy he is. Look at his relationship with God, the blessings that God has poured out on him, the ability that he has to do this. Even when some of the furniture is mentioned in Kings, it's almost like an afterthought. Oh yeah, by the way, Solomon made some lampstands and some table of presents. I suppose that's important to mention too. But really, did you see that Solomon made this? That really seems to be the focus. Which is in keeping with the book of Kings, because the emphasis is on Kings and emphasizing what those actual kings did. And yet the writer of Chronicles has a little bit different focus. It's not a focus on Solomon building the temple as much as it is on the temple that Solomon built. The focus is really on the temple itself here in Chronicles. He's not focused on who bit what. He's not emphasizing the difference between gold and bronze as much as he is on just emphasizing the temple itself and the various pieces that you would find at the temple. That's why in chapter 3 here in 2 Chronicles, we saw the description of the height and the emphasis on gold. Everything was of gold and the glory and the splendor. So that as you're reading 2 Chronicles chapter 3, you begin to almost feel overwhelmed at just the splendor of this building. How amazing this building is. And now as we switch to chapter 4 and we begin to talk more about the furniture and what's in it, the focus is still on look at this temple. Look at how amazing it is. Look at everything that's in it. Look at the various pieces that are made. Look at the furniture. Look at what it's for. Look at the altar. You can come and you can offer sacrifices. Look at all these tables. Look at them all. Look at all these lampstands, which is really great. Except we're left with that question, what does any of that have to do with me? What do I care that there's more? What do I care that the building's higher? What difference does that make to us today? We know about the furniture in the temple because it's the same furniture that's in the tabernacle, so why do we really need to know about that all over again? And yet I think part of it is that's the chronicler's exact point. The furniture that is here in the temple is not here because of Solomon's wisdom. Not that he's disagreeing with the writer of Kings that Solomon is wise, but he's really emphasizing that Solomon is not the one who decided to build these. Instead, there was a prior pattern, and that pattern goes all the way back to the tabernacle. It's not as though Solomon decided, you know what, I'm going to build an altar. Didn't get mentioned in Kings, but I think an altar would be nice. No, he knows that he's supposed to build an altar because there was an altar in the tabernacle. It's not that Solomon decided, you know, we should have an outer court and an inner court, like in verse 9. We should have a court for the priests. We should have a court for the common people. This would be a great design. No, the chronicler goes to great lengths to make sure that we understand none of this was Solomon's idea. None of this was Hammurabi's idea. This all goes back to the tabernacle, which means it all goes back to the prescription of God Almighty. God is the one who designed this. In fact, the chronicler even goes in order. He starts with the building itself. We saw that in chapter 3. He talks about the Holy of Holies, which is where the cherubim are, and then the front of the temple with the pillars. But then he marches in order. He goes from the altar to the bronze sea, then to the holy place with the lampstands, and then with the tables. In fact, he even says that the lampstands in verse 7 are prescribed. We're left kind of wondering, prescribed by who? Prescribed by David? Perhaps. Prescribed by Solomon? Perhaps, but I think given the emphasis of all the furniture being in order and the same furniture being in the temple as in the tabernacle, I think we would probably say prescribed by God to Moses. God's the one who said there should be a lampstand. And so he's following the pattern that's been given to Moses on Mount Sinai, which is really establishing then a continuity between the tabernacle and the temple. And that really seems to be, I think, what the chronicler here is emphasizing. It was interesting as I went through the different commentaries and read their takes on this chapter, almost all of them said, you know, it seems like the chronicler is going out of his way to make sure we understand there's a connection between Solomon's temple and the tabernacle. And I think that comes through here as he's explaining the furniture, the same way that it is arranged in the tabernacle, the same furniture that's in the tabernacle. Of course, we might ask, well, isn't that just assumed? Why do we need to emphasize that it's the same? Don't we just understand that? But keep in mind when the chronicler is writing and the condition of the temple as he's writing. He's writing after the exile. And if there's an actual temple that he's looking at, which is very probable, it's not the temple of Solomon. This temple that he's describing here has been destroyed and has been burned to the ground. Instead, the temple that he's looking at is the temple that Zerubbabel built. It's a house that Israel looks at and says, it's not the same. It's not the same house. The chronicler then has a theological reason to say, oh, but it is the same. It is the same house. It's the exact same house. It's the same temple. Just as the temple of Solomon and the tabernacle were the same, so too these two versions of the temple are the same. It's got the same furniture. It's got the same design. It's got the same layout. The tabernacle may have been, you know, transitory and mobile. The temple is more permanent, but it's the same house. It's the same building. See the continuity, see the connection between tabernacle and temple. In order for the chronicler to be able to say, see the continuity between the temple of Solomon and the temple of Zerubbabel, it's the same house. In fact, in the book of Haggai, Haggai chapter 2, Haggai says, while standing in front of the new temple, he says, how many of you saw this house in its former glory? Not how many of you saw the former house in its glory, how many of you saw this house in its former glory? For Haggai, it's the same house. It doesn't matter that Zerubbabel built it. This is the temple, and there is a connection between temple and temple, temple and tabernacle. The chronicler is going out of his way to draw that continuity so that we understand it's the same house. This is the same temple. Nothing has changed. The furniture might have changed slightly, that there might be more of it. It might be, but it's arranged the same way. It's the same furniture. They didn't come up with any other ideas that weren't present in the tabernacle. They didn't say, hey, let's have two altars instead of one. It's the same, so that we would see that line of continuation, which is crucial for you and I and answers that question of, okay, why is this important? Because there is still a continuity between the temples of God in the Old Testament and the temple of God in the New Testament. When we are told by Paul in Ephesians chapter 2 that we are the temple of God, he does not mean that in a way that is completely separate from the temples of the Old Testament, or even to some degree separate from Christ as the temple. A temple is a temple. It is where God dwells. We, the people of God, are as much this house where God dwells by his Spirit as this house here in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and chapter 4. In many ways, we're not a different house. We're the same house. We are a different version of the same house, but there is a continuity that runs through all the temples of the Old Testament. We are as much the temple as the tabernacle, where the glory of God filled the tabernacle so that even Moses couldn't enter, as much as the temple in Jerusalem, the first temple built by Solomon, the second temple built by Zerubbabel. And even if we go all the way back to the very beginning and want to make the argument that the Garden of Eden functioned very much like a temple where God dwelt with Adam and Eve, we still have this line of continuity that runs all the way through today, that we are the temple of God. You know, I know when we come to details like this, like 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and chapter 4, our eyes kind of begin to glaze over. And even though we might see the connection between 1 Kings chapter 6 and chapter 7, the second half of the book of Exodus, we kind of think to ourselves, look, we've been through all this before. Why do I need to know this all over again? We get it. And yet we're reading about the history of the temple that we are. We're reading about our history and really our purpose as the people of God. That we are the people of God, we are the temple of God, where God dwells. We're reminded that our purpose is the same, to remind us of the heavenly presence of God into which Christ entered to place his blood upon the eternal mercy seat, so that we can be the temple of God on earth. That access point, A-X-I-S, the access point of the presence of God, where people access, A-C-C-E-S-S, they access the presence of God through the people of God, through the temple. We are that temple. We are that access and that access point. God dwells here among his people. That's where his dwelling is, because we are the temple of God. The chronicler is reminding Israel that the aim and the purpose and the function of that temple as they see it continues in Zerubbabel's day, as it does in ours, as we gather even to offer spiritual sacrifices to God in Christ Jesus. We are still the place where God dwells. And so the chronicler here is emphasizing that continuity, even as the Apostle Paul picks up the same theme and says, we are the temple of God, where God dwells by his Spirit. And yet the chronicler says there's also a difference between tabernacle and temple. There are 10 tables in the holy place, rather than just the one mentioned in Exodus. More than likely, these 10 tables are actually the 10 golden tables that the 10 lampstands are going on. Because in 1 Kings, there's kind of a mention of the table of presence. And so it seems as though the chronicler is kind of adding, there was the table of presence, but the 10 lamps stood on 10 tables. We kind of wonder, though, why 10? Why did we increase the number? Not to mention the fact that we're also told that there are 100 basins of gold in verse 8. We've been told lots of detail about the tabernacle and the temple being similar, and yet we get a sense that there is something bigger and better about this temple. We saw that in chapter 3 with the size, with the amount of gold, with the glory, the splendor, and even here with the amount of furniture. It's still the same furniture, but there's just more of it. So this temple, Solomon's temple, is bigger and has more stuff than the tabernacle, which reminds us that while the chronicler wants to associate the temple with the tabernacle, the temple of Solomon is also more glorious than the tabernacle. It's bigger and better. More furniture, more gold, more ornate. This is, in a sense, an upgrade from the tabernacle. And yet in the chronicler's day, the temple seems to have taken a step back because he's looking at the temple of Zerubbabel. They're all looking at the temple of Zerubbabel. That question, how many of you saw this house in its former glory? It's a question that is met with weeping in the book of Haggai, so much so that they can't tell the difference between the people who are weeping over the temple of Solomon being lost and the people who are weeping for joy because this new temple has been built. They're weeping because they understand that that glory of Solomon's temple is gone. The Ark of the Covenant is gone. You'll notice it's not mentioned here in Chronicles or in Kings. The golden cherubim that seem to have been on top of the Ark of the Covenant, they are mentioned. But the ark itself, the mercy seat, is not mentioned. That might be in keeping with the words of Jeremiah that foretold that after the exile, no one would say the ark of the Lord. It would not be remembered or even come into mind. And that does seem to be somewhat true here. It's not even mentioned. But that was not the only thing missing from the temple of Solomon. The temple of Zerubbabel simply did not measure up in splendor. It didn't measure up in glory, which again resulted in great weeping as they were dedicating it. Which I think is why the chronicler is at pains to show that the temple is more glorious than the tabernacle. Bigger, more gold, more furniture. Because the prophet Haggai said, the temple of Zerubbabel, which looked like nothing in the eyes of the Israelites returned from exile, he said it would actually be more glorious than the temple of Solomon. He says, you've seen this temple, and you've recognized that it is lacking its glory. And yet God himself promises in Haggai chapter 2, I will fill this house with glory. I will fill it with a greater glory. And even the kings of the nations will bring their offerings into it. And I think it would be easy if you're an Israelite there, standing in front of Zerubbabel's temple, to look at the lack of furniture, to look at the lack of gold, the lack of the ark, and to conclude this temple has less glory than the previous temple. And yet Haggai says, no, with eyes of faith, you recognize that actually this temple, it's going to have even greater glory, a glory that's actually going to outmatch even the temple of Solomon. It's not a step backward. It's actually still a step forward. The temple has replaced the tabernacle in a more glorious way. And now there is a glory that is coming in that second temple that's going to be even more glorious than this temple. And one day there's going to be an even greater glory that's going to come into the temple, the presence of God coming into the temple. It would be more glorious on the one hand, because eventually King Herod would come and would cover the entire temple with so much gold, so much more furniture, bigger buildings than even Solomon's temple. And so there would one day be a greater physical glory to this particular iteration of the temple. And as for the lack of the Ark of the Covenant, well, you and I know that the glory of God would actually come to Jerusalem. In fact, the glory of God in the person of Jesus Christ would actually enter this temple, Zerubbabel's temple. Many scholars have tried to make the argument that that's what Haggai has in mind, that one day Christ would come into Zerubbabel's temple in a way that really hadn't happened in Solomon's temple. I'm one of those who believes that instead what Haggai is looking forward to is actually the church coming as the temple, and that is the Spirit that is going to take up residence in the church, just as that cloud would fill the tabernacle and the temple as we see in the Old Testament. But either way, as he's looking at this particular building, and as he's thinking of this particular building, he's trying to say to Israel, this is not the end of the glory. This is not a step back. You have to look at this building with eyes of faith and recognize that the purposes of God for the temple continue. It's not just the building itself that continues and is continuous, but the glory of God continues to expand, and that will take place even in this temple that you look at that seems like nothing in your eyes. It's going to be filled with glory. Which is an important reminder for you and I, because as we understand that we are the temple of God, and that God has taken up residence by that glory cloud, by his Spirit, filling his church, filling his people, there are times, I think, that you and I look back at the Old Testament and we think, now there was the glory. There was the splendor. You could see it as you were coming to Jerusalem. You know, the early rabbis would write during the time of Herod's temple, and I presume even Solomon's temple, one of the wonders of the ancient world, as they're coming, they would talk of the sun gleaming off all the gold on the top of the Temple Mount. It was just glorious. It was a splendor to behold. And I think there's times that you and I look around and we feel a bit like the people gathered at Zerubbabel's temple. You know, we keep talking about all this glory in the church, but I just don't see it. I don't see it. We seem defeated. We seem overcome. We're supposed to see all this glory, and I just don't see it. And so there are people who even look back to the Old Testament and say, you know, we look for that day when Herod's temple is rebuilt. Or you'll even have some that will look at the temple that's described in the book of Ezekiel, and they'll say, now when that temple is built, then we'll have some glory. And yet the writers of the New Testament are saying, no, I think you've missed it. It's not about a building anymore. It's about the people of God. And they are far more glorious than any building that has ever existed or will ever exist. The closest we ever get to a building is John's vision in Revelation of the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. And yet even in the book of Revelation, it's clear that the New Jerusalem is the church. It is the people of God. That, says John, that is the temple, and it is full of far more glory than any of these buildings. And yet many times, in many ways, it takes a greater faith to see that greater glory, to see that the glory of God now dwells among his people in the church by his Spirit. It's the connection that you and I now make, that we are the presence of God. God's glory is here. God's glory is present among us. And yet again, many times we don't see it. We begin to lose hope, and we begin to be discouraged. And yet it's in the midst of those times that we need to remember the words of the chronicler. Just because you don't see it with physical eyes doesn't mean it's not there. Doesn't mean that it's not coming. Doesn't mean that we are not going to be with our eternal God in a glorious eternal city forever as the New Jerusalem, where the kings of the nations will bring their glory into it. There's a continuity, even there. That's what we long for. That's what we understand that we are. We are being called by the chronicler with eyes of faith to make the connection between tabernacle and temple, between temple and second temple, and then in the New Testament, between temple and the people of God. We are the people of God where God dwells by his glory. That greater glory has come in the person of Jesus Christ. That greater glory has come in the Holy Spirit. God now dwells among us. We are the glorious people of God. And one day, we will be far more glorious than can possibly be imagined, because we will be perfect, a perfect temple. It's easy to get discouraged as we look around. Haggai knew it. The chronicler knew it. But that's why it's so important to remember who we are and to see with those eyes of faith. May 2 Chronicles 4 indeed remind us that we are in Christ. We are the temple of God. We are filled with his glory. May we see the continuity. May we see the surpassing glory of Christ and his Spirit in us. Rather than being discouraged, may we see, may we remember, and may we rejoice. We are the temple of God. Let's pray.